this particular event, in a sense, requires two introductions, because David Steele, who is the Samuel Arch Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, is our speaker, and I could say a lot about David and about his books, especially his book, The New Financial Deal, Understanding the Dodd-Frank Act, or the soon-to-be-repealed Dodd-Frank Act, and unintended consequences. The Dodd-Frank Act was, in my view, a sort of little tiny step toward financial regulation, but evidently these days, even a little tiny step is a giant step for people who oppose any kind of government regulation. And so it's hard to know what the future of Dodd-Frank will be, but to know anything about it at all, David's book is absolutely required reading. And I'm really thrilled he would come from my alma mater, the University of Pennsylvania, to join us for this event. So welcome. But we're also here because it's important to introduce Bill Stuns, the late Bill Stuns, who's was a professor of law at Harvard Law School, and who, for those who know him know him as one of the most extraordinary, compassionate, brilliant, and sensitive human beings that's ever walked the face of the earth. I got involved in working with evangelical Christian academics and had traveled around the country at various institutions and was told that, hey, Harvard Law School hired an evangelical Christian, you want to meet him? And I did. And getting to know Bill and reading his enormously impressive scholarship, which is culminated with the publication just this month of The Collapse of American Criminal Justice from Harvard University Press. But even more, getting to know Bill and watching him in the blog that he would do with David, watching him talk about and wrestle with the enormous pain he was suffering in the last years of his life was just absolutely inspiring to me. I am not a religious believer, but when I face issues of, you know, trying to grapple with why do bad things happen and so on, I invariably turn to the things that Bill wrote. As well, by the way, a strong recommendation for an astonishing book written by the theologian Nicholas Waltersdorf about the death of his son. And there's just a way that people who have such deep and profound faith wrestle with issues like this that is just inspiring even to people who can't go along with them and share their faith. And I certainly feel that way about Bill. And so the idea came to us of inviting David here to celebrate Bill's life, to talk about his work. And I'm just thrilled we could do this. So
it's a real privilege to be here, actually, to be here again. This is the second time I've been here, and each time I've kind of been channeling Bill Stuns. And one last time I was talking about a piece that we wrote together. I found that using Bill's name together with mine whenever possible really changes the response I get from people. If I send something to law review editors and it has Bill's name on it, they light up and they say yes, for a good reason. What I thought I'd do in the next 15 minutes or so, and feel free to interrupt me during those 15 minutes, is three things to sort of talk about. Three pieces or three components of Bill's life, each of which obviously fits together with the other. The first is, I think of as, why did Harvard Law Review want Bill to come, which is Bill's criminal justice scholarship. So I'll talk a little bit about his criminal justice scholarship. And then the second is Bill's writing on Christian legal theory, Christianity and law. And then finally, I'll say a few words about Bill's faith and his struggling with pain and with cancer the last decade or so of his life, as Aaron's already alluded to. So starting with criminal justice and why did Harvard Law School want Bill to come up here? As won't surprise you, he had most of the I was about to say ordinary, spectacular accomplishments of people at places like BC and Harvard. He was number one in his class at Virginia Law School. He had two clerkships. The first was with Lewis Pollack, who was is a former dean of both Yale and Penn law schools. Second was with Justice Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court. So Bill graduated number one. He did 2 years of clerkship, and then he came back to Virginia to teach for a little over 12 or 13 years before moving to Harvard. He also had a reputation as an extraordinary institutional citizen, as essential to the law school at Virginia, and when he got to Harvard, being essential to Harvard as well. But what he was best known for was his criminal justice scholarship. So that's really what I want to talk about for a few minutes. He was, by something like popular consensus, the leading criminal justice scholar of the last generation, really transformed the way people think about criminal justice scholarship. And to appreciate Bill's influence, I think it's helpful to compare what I think of as BB to AB, before Bill to after Bill. Before Bill, criminal law and criminal procedure were seen as two completely different disciplines. Criminal law meant thinking about theories of punishment, typically in philosophical terms, whether deterrence is appropriate, whether retribution is appropriate. That was seen as a completely different enterprise from criminal procedure. And what criminal procedure scholarship consisted of before Bill, which would be 1970s, 1980s, into the 1990s, really 1970s and 1980s, was engaging with the Warren Courts. As most of you probably know, the Warren Court is the label given to the Supreme Court during the years when Earl Warren was Chief Justice. Warren is most famous for having shepherded the Supreme Court through Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, which was early in his tenure as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and he managed to get a unanimous vote for Brown, and that was seen as a great political accomplishment on the Supreme Court. But in the 50s, and especially in the 60s, what the Warren Court is best known for is its criminal procedure decisions, a series of decisions that expanded protections for criminal defendants. The one that's most famous is the Miranda case, which gave rise to the Miranda warnings that defendants have to be given. The Gideon case, Gideon versus Wainwright, finds a constitutional guarantee that defendants will have a lawyer. A series of Warren Court decisions expanded the so-called exclusionary rule of the Fourth Amendment, which is a rule that prohibits evidence that's improperly obtained from being introduced at trial. So criminal procedure scholarship in the 60s and 70s really focused on the Warren Court, and much of it was cheerleading for the Warren Court, was praising what the Warren Court had done, criticizing the more conservative turn that started in the 1970s, and as I've already mentioned, really was disconnected from criminal law scholarship. They were just seen as two different fields. One of the main things Bill did early in his career was brought the two fields together, was reintegrated or integrated criminal law and criminal procedure. So now if you talk to a criminal law or criminal procedure scholarship, it's just obvious to them that they're all part of the same enterprise. It was not obvious in the 1990s. What Bill also did was bring a focus, relatedly, on the system as a whole, not just focusing on what the Supreme Court is doing, or even just focusing on, say, what police are doing, but focusing on each of the components of the system, the primary components being police, prosecutors, the legislatures that are enacting criminal laws, and the courts that are ruling on them. Bill brought a focus on all of these pieces and how they worked together. And I'll say a little bit more in just a second about his particular, or a couple of his particular contributions. But I think it's important to emphasize as well that the mode of Bill's scholarship was in many respects as important as the content of the scholarship. Bill, somewhat like Alan, gored everybody's ox. He said that the Warren Court actually hurt the criminal defendants that it was trying to help, that the Warren Court revolution had a perverse effect of doing exactly the opposite of what it was purporting to do, which was purporting to help criminal defendants. Which might lead you to think that he would end up in a comfortable conservative position of saying the Warren Court is lousy and the quicker we undo everything that they stood for, the better. But what Bill said instead was actually the Warren Court wasn't radical enough. It thought it was being radical. It actually did the opposite of what it thought it was doing, and what it should have done is been even more radical. And for Bill, what that meant was it should have focused more on substantive rights and less on procedural. So Bill gored everybody's ox. He was very fond of ironies and paradoxes. If you look at Bill's articles, the first page of almost every article says, there's a paradox here. The rest of us didn't know there was a paradox there. But Bill says, usually says there's a paradox and it's an obvious paradox. We didn't know the paradox was there. We didn't know how to solve it once we were told it was there. And Bill offered both of those things. So he loved paradox, he loved irony, and just to give you an example of this, in a way, the Warren Court example was one big example. Another example in Bill's early work was an article about, in part, about a series of Supreme Court cases that essentially said students in schools, and there were a couple analogous contexts as well, but students in schools have less right against search than the rest of us do. That a principal in a school can do things in the way of searching and forcing people to turn over pocketbooks and stuff that would not be allowed in other contexts involving adults. Those decisions predictably were heavily criticized by most criminal procedure scholarships as being completely unfair to students. Bill's response was actually those decisions help students. And the reason they help students is because if you take away principals' right to search students' belongings, principals will respond by doing something even worse. They'll take away student lockers and say that you can't even have any privacy within the school. Very characteristic Bill move, that the obvious reaction to a decision or an idea is exactly backwards. Very familiar part of Bill's work. Not surprisingly, given this bent of mind, he also just loved ideas. He loved to argue. He loved to debate ideas. An example of this for me, and it's kind of an abstract example, but I once asked him if he'd ever interviewed an entry-level candidate, somebody who was just applying for a teaching job, that he knew was a sure thing, that when he interviewed the person, he knew this person was going to be a star. And he said, his answer was yes, only one time. I can't decide whether to mention the person or not. A number of people would know who this person is. And the reason that Bill knew this person was going to be a star is because no matter what you asked him, he had a kind of contrary, surprising response to it, and he was interested in the idea. He just clearly loved talking about ideas and wrestling with ideas. For Bill, that's what being a scholar meant. It also meant being willing to change your mind. One of the things that's surprising to me about Bill's book is his new book, which is really his magnum opus, as Alan said, just came out, is he's clearly changed his mind on a couple of things, and it makes me a little uncomfortable, because one of the things he's changed his mind on is prohibition. We wrote an article where we said, you know, prohibition is everything that's wrong with legal moralism in America. You know, it shows that when you try to legislate morality, it backfires, which I still think is true, but in the book, Bill says prohibition actually was a great thing. It was a democratic experiment where politics worked. It was politically put in place, and when it proved ineffective, it was politically removed, which I think is a brilliant insight. It's a little uncomfortable for me, because when I go around talking about Bill's article, saying prohibition was a disaster is the one thing that gets a positive response every time I do it. So I'm not sure what I'm going to do now. I have to come up with a positive response from somewhere else. Let me just very briefly describe two of his most famous criminal procedure articles, just kind of in a soundbite. What I think was really the breakthrough article for his very first articles were very important, but he wrote a breakthrough article in 1997 called The Uneasy Relationship Between Criminal Procedure and Criminal Justice, which argued, among many other things, made this argument that the war in court revolution was actually counterproductive. And one of the arguments he made in this article was that what the war in court procedural protections did, because of the fact that the lawyers for defendants, the court-appointed lawyers that a significant majority of criminal defendants are forced to use, because they are poorly paid, that criminal defense lawyers do not make much money, what the war in court decisions did was discouraged defendants from raising defenses on the merits, from saying, I'm innocent, I didn't actually do this, and encouraged them to raise procedural defenses, to say this evidence shouldn't be introduced because it violates the exclusionary. Just a brilliant, troubling, disturbing insight, I think. But the argument was that for poor defendants, the war in court led to a proceduralization of criminal justice, and that our criminal justice system is the worst for it. Another really classic stunts article, the two that I think of as the classic stunts articles, the first one is this 1997 article. The second one is a 2001 article called The Pathological Politics of Criminal Law. Very complicated article, makes a lot of different arguments, but one of the most famous arguments that comes out of it is that criminal law in this country is a one-way ratchet, is the metaphor that he used, that our criminal law always expands, it never contracts. And the reason it never contracts is because whenever there is a form of high-profile misbehavior that's not obviously covered by the criminal law, there's a rush to propose a criminal law to criminalize it. Politicians can't afford to vote against the criminal law. If you vote no, you're likely to lose your job. If you vote yes, you may keep your job, even if voting yes means putting a law that's completely wrong-headed into place. So this idea of criminal law is a one-way ratchet, another very famous stunts idea. He also, in other articles, argued that we should focus less on privacy, on protecting people's privacy through the exclusionary rule, and more on preventing police coercion and violence, and that the focus on privacy really is problematic in many ways, one of which is it tends to favor rich defendants over poor defendants. Rich defendants have a lot more privacy than poor defendants do. His new book is a sprawling magisterial magnum opus. It's a big, complex, at times confusing, historical treatment of American criminal justice since Reconstruction. He makes lots and lots of different arguments in it. Sort of a footnote on this, it's a very nice review of the book by Lincoln Kaplan in the current issue of Democracy. That's very well worth reading. It's about 5 pages long. He really nicely distills the book. Bill makes a number of arguments. He's very concerned about American criminal justice. He believes that the Supreme Court took a wrong turn in its emphasis on procedural rights rather than substantive rights. He thinks that the Equal Protection Clause should be used a lot more in criminal law, and that if the Equal Protection Clause were used, there would be many fewer black men in jail than there are under our current system. He also believes that there's been a loss in local control of criminal justice, that 100 years ago, the police were local, prosecutors were local, lots of cases went to trial, and you had a lot of people being let off because the jury was neighbors of the person who was the defendant, and on the given facts didn't feel like it was appropriate to convict. And Bill's view is that we should try to recapture some of that local control. Second thing I'll talk about, and I'll speed up now since I'm, as usual, talking at too much length, is what Bill had to say about Christian legal theory. There's some antecedents in Bill's work of what he said more recently, early on. There's some early antecedents in his work. Late 1990s, he wrote several articles for First Things, a journal that probably many of you are familiar with. But the Watershed piece was a piece in the Harvard Law Review in 2003. It's actually a book review of a book of essays with Michael McConnell and two other law professors as editors. 2003, Harvard Law Review essay called, I think it's Christian Legal Theory, I forget the exact title. Before this piece, there were almost no articles from a discernibly Christian perspective in prominent top 20 kinds of law reviews for most of the 20th century, with a couple of big exceptions. The big exceptions were, the main exceptions were the First Amendment Religion Clause article. So you have Michael McConnell writing about the religion clauses in the Harvard Law Review. But other kinds of work bringing a Christian perspective to bear on legal issues, almost absent entirely for most of the 20th century. I did a search of this. I spent my summer going through the indexes of law review articles through the 20th century a few years ago. And it's quite remarkable that in a country that is so infused with Christianity, in the elite law reviews, you didn't see much writing. So Bill's article was really a breakthrough article. And as with all of Bill's work, it was very surprising. He was very critical of what he called legal moralism, which he associated with what the religious right had been doing. He argued that that true Christian legal theory would be humble, that it would be about humility, and not always assuming that our arguments are the best or only arguments, which is not the kind of stance that is thick on the ground in law schools, and that maybe Christian legal theory finally shouldn't be about passing laws, but it should be about doing our job as well as we can. And he has a riff in the article about Jesus as carpenter, and probably Jesus took his job as carpenter very seriously, working for his father. Bill developed these ideas in more detail in some respects, these ideas about Christian perspective on law, in some work that the two of us did together, an article that we co-wrote, and we also co-wrote a piece for a book that Alan and Eric did, a really wonderful conference and wonderful book. I should note, even though I'm using up too much time, I can't resist noting that it was one of the great privileges of my life to co-author several articles and a blog with Bill. It didn't always feel like a privilege. However, working with Bill was a many-splendored thing. And what I often think about, and I said this at his funeral, was there's a scene in the movie Amadeus, which I saw many, many years ago, about Mozart, where Mozart is dying, and Salieri, who is his competitor, very very accomplished composer. He just isn't quite Mozart. Is helping Mozart finish one of his final compositions, I think. And you see Salieri, he understands where Mozart is going with the piece, and he says, yeah, I get it. And then he just hits a brick wall, and he has no idea where the piece is going to go next. And Mozart comes back with just some brilliant turn in the argument, and then Salieri will pick it up again, and then he loses the thread and has no idea where they're going. I felt like that when I worked with Phil. I felt like I could channel him for a while. I mean, you start to think a little bit like, but you sort of like start to think like a dumbed down Bill. But when you work with them, there's always, you know, there's some twist that you never could have imagined, and sometimes can not be great for your self-esteem, but it was an extraordinary experience. The kinds of things that we had an article that we called Christianity and the Modest Rule of Law, and the argument that we made in the article, one of the arguments we made, was that there's a tendency, and we were talking particularly among evangelical Christians, to love the law too much, to want to do too much with the law. And the argument that we made is that we anchored it in the Sermon on the Mount and developed an argument out of the Sermon on the Mount, but the metaphor that sticks with me about the article is that law has to play a double game. It plays a double game in the sense that we think of law as constraining sinful citizens. That's the role of law, that's an appropriate role of law, but we often forget that legislators and law enforcers also are sinful. And you can't simply focus on constraining sin, you also have to focus on not inviting the law enforcers to sin themselves. And in many contexts where we try to do too much with the law, what we end up doing is inviting discrimination in the law. And prohibition was our classic example of that, back when we thought prohibition was a bad idea. Some other things that Bill did, he has an essay that will be coming out in Virginia Law Review in the spring. It was based on a talk he gave there, where he talks about, at the end of the essay, about Martin Luther King and the argument. He talks in that context about positive possibilities for the law and argues that part of the brilliance of the civil rights movement is the laws that came out of it were laws that fostered relationship. The Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act were designed to create an integrated society, not to punish anybody primarily, but to create relationship. And Bill, at the very end of the talk, said, I'm going to risk breaking up as I say this, but I'll try not to, said, I talked about Martin Luther King and how he fought and bled and died for the right to have relationship with people who did not want to have relationship with him. And so that is a big piece of Bill's positive conception of what the law to do. We need to be modest about it, but there are circumstances where the law has a positive role to play. Final aspect of Bill that I'd like to talk about is his faith and his pain and his cancer. Bill grew up in the church. His family was church going when he was a kid. But he did not consider himself, I think, fully to be a Christian until late in, and by that we mean, for those of you who don't share our little evangelical culture that Bill and I both come out of, the catchphrase would be, he committed his life to Christ, by which he would mean, and I would mean, that he became convinced that Jesus really was resurrected from the dead, and that he offers us eternal life to all who believe in him. Bill reached this conclusion in his late teens and early 20s. Number of things that played into it. One of them was the writings of C.S. Lewis, and I've often found I find that striking and not surprising, because C.S. Lewis's writing has some of the same kinds of quality that Bill's writing has. Very surprising arguments that are not intuitive initially, but intuitive once they're pointed out to you. effective use of metaphor and things of that sort. Bill's faith manifested itself in his scholarly career in a number of different ways, but there are two I want to mention. One is, you can't talk about Bill without talking about humility. I've already talked about it as part of his theory of Christian legal scholarship. But everybody who knew Bill, was friends with him at all, or students of his, or colleagues of his, has a story that goes more or less like this. I called Bill up. I had a problem with an article I was working on. Bill took 2 hours to talk to me on the phone and work through it. He gave me some ideas I never would have thought of myself. And at the end of the call, Bill apologized for taking up so much of my afternoon. Over and over, people had, and he meant it. I mean, it wasn't just something that he put on. And it's kind of a parlor game in law school circles to try to analyze where Bill's humility came from, because it's real, and not many of us have it. Some of us think it had something to do with the fact that he was the fourth boy in a family with four boys. The first time he applied to law school at Virginia, he didn't get in to Virginia, and he lived in Charlottesville for a year, working as a clerk at a local inn for the year, and before he finally got in. I always suspected that might have something to do with it, because if anything is going to teach you that you're not better than other people, being a clerk at an inn, it's probably good training. But the real reason, I think, was Bill's faith. He felt very, very deeply that what his faith is about is counting others greater than yourself, and recognizing the image of God in each of us. The other quality of Bill's scholarly career was that he absolutely loved his colleagues and the legal academic community. He wrote an op-ed in 2004 that probably at least a couple of you have seen, called Faculty Clubs and Church Pews. David Brooks singled it out as one of the top essays in his view of 2004, where he said, actually, evangelical Christians and Harvard Law School faculty members have more in common than they think. And if they realized that, churches would be better off, and so would law schools be better off. This is going to be hard to get through, but my favorite example of Bill's love for his colleagues comes from the last time I talked to Bill. I should probably have written this out. We're not supposed to write out and read. I had gotten an email in probably late February, Bill died in March, from a colleague of Bill's, who's a very dear friend of both of ours, saying, you probably need to say goodbye to Bill now. He had just visited him at his house. Bill was at this point in a bed had a bed right inside the front door 24 hours a day, and this friend went and saw Bill, and it was clear he was dying. And so a friend sends me this email, says, if you're planning on saying goodbye to Bill, you probably ought to do it soon. So I write an email to Bill with the tagline, goodbye, at the top of it. I told him how much I loved him, how much I appreciated, everything he had meant to me. Sent it. I thought that was the last time, last contact we would ever be. Got on the train. Went to my office. I step inside my office. The phone's ringing, and it's Bill. He's not gotten my email. He's just calling me up. He's about to die. I'm saying goodbye to him. So why is Bill calling me up? The reason he's calling me up is he was worried about the dedication to his book, to the book that's just come out. He starts out the conversation saying, I know that as Christians we're supposed to dedicate our lives to Jesus Christ, and that this dedication should say to Jesus Christ. But Carol Steiker and Mike Klarman and Danny Richman, my colleagues, have done so much to make this book possible and to make my academic career possible, I really feel like I should dedicate it to them. Is it okay to dedicate it to them? So he's dying, and he's worried about how he's supposed to interact with the community around him. To me, that's the ultimate example of just the way he loved this community that we're part of. And there, everybody has different examples, but that's the one that will stick with me. The last 11 years of Bill's life were hell. He had back problems. He threw out his back. He had thrown it out when he was in high school. He had been fine for many years. Threw it out in 2000, right before he was coming up to Harvard. And for the rest of his life, had excruciating back pain. One of the things that was most frustrating about it for him, I think, was that people don't believe that your pain is as bad as it is. And he had to teach from a wheelchair at various points, went to all kinds of doctors. He really believed the doctors didn't believe him about the seriousness of the pain. So that in 2008, when he got his diagnosis of colon cancer, which was not caught until it was well advanced, almost certainly because Bill was in so much pain that the pain of the colon cancer didn't seem any different from what he was used to, I think there was a part of Bill that was a little bit relieved. That I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but that he had, people could understand where he was. He wrote about his pain. He wrote a lot about it on the blog that we did together, Less Than the Least. And I would highly commend going to the blog sometime and just on the, where it's divided into subjects, there's a subject line, Health and Daily Life, which is all Bill's posts about his cancer. He described it with a vividness that just really touched thousands and thousands of people's lives. He talked about the pain he experienced as being like having an alarm clock strapped to your head. This is in the introduction. Some of you may have seen, always on, you can't turn it off. He talked about the cancer. He said that the metaphor people use with cancer about how you're fighting the cancer is right about it being a fight, but has the metaphor all wrong. He said, Bill said, I'm not fighting cancer. What I feel like is happening is the cancer and my doctors are engaged in a battle, and my body is the battlefield. And he wrote a number of things like this, just breathtaking descriptions of what he was going through. To be perfectly honest, when Bill, really even before the cancer diagnosis, I, as a fellow Christian friend of his, was afraid that it was going to shake his faith. And I was really worried that, you know, I guess it's a natural reaction. You know, I'm going to call Bill sometime, and he's going to say, you know, I don't believe this stuff anymore. But that's exactly the opposite of what happened. His faith became stronger. His views about some issues changed, and his view about pain changed in a way that's very, very striking. There's a real tendency in our circles, our being Bill and I, the kind of Protestant evangelical circles, to do two things, and I'm really paraphrasing Bill when I say this, or respond to pain or suffering or terrible events in two related ways. One is to say it's God's way of disciplining us, sort of like a father disciplining his child. There's a lot in the Bible about that, and I believe that some things are meant to discipline us, but Bill became convinced that cancer and his back pain was not, that's not the way God views that. And the other thing, relatedly, is there's a tendency to assume that all of this is part of some good plan that God has for our lives, and every element of it is good. And Bill became absolutely convinced that neither of those things are true, that God hates pain and suffering every bit as much as we do, and that God the metaphor Bill used was makes lemons out of lemonade, that he doesn't want suffering to happen, but he makes good out of that suffering, not that he wants that to happen. The passage that in Scripture that was very important for Bill in that regard is the story of Joseph in the Old Testament. Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers. They think they're selling him to death. Joseph goes to Egypt, ends up becoming important and saving his nation, essentially. So I want to read a letter that Bill wrote where he talks about these. I want to read a couple. It's kind of a long passage, and I know I'm almost done. I apologize for talking in such length. So what remains of Romans 8:28, which is a passage that says all things work for the good of those who love love God? So what remains of Romans 8:28, if you hold the views that Bill holds about pain, or of the passage in Genesis when Joseph says to his brothers, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good"? I'm no Bible scholar. I don't know the Greek I assume Paul used, nor the Hebrew in which Genesis was originally written. But I believe those passages describe a God who uses the worst things to produce the best things, redeeming useful hells without making them anything other than hellish. I'm an academic. I believe in beautiful ideas. And the principle of taking the sourest lemons and making the sweetest lemonade, taking Joseph's slavery and imprisonment and using it to spare a nation from starving, taking the sons, this is Jesus' torture and murder, and using that to save the number no man can count, is the most beautiful idea I've ever encountered. I want, more than anything else, to live what time I have left in light of this, he's writing in 2008, to live in such a way that my illness might be made useful, that even this ugliest of diseases might somehow be used to produce something lovely. I believe in that goal, and my soul is committed to it. But I still can't bring myself to say that the pain in the base of my neck and at the top half of my right leg is a good thing, nor that the cancer that is ripping the life from me is a blessing. I wouldn't wish those things on my worst enemy. Like any parent, I'd be horrified if any of my children suffered them. Easily the worst thing about a cancer diagnosis is the fear that one has bequeathed this disease to one's kids. To think that they might feel what I feel, and on my account, leaves me undone. I can't bear it. That isn't the way anyone thinks about blessings. We want our children to have those. Rather, it's the way one thinks about curses that a good God redeems. Chronic pain and cancer are curses. Awful, ugly, killing things. Enemies to all who love life and beauty. They are evidence of a world out of joint, pieces of life turned against itself. I believe that. Yet I also believe in a God who brings beauty to all he touches and who deigns to touch the likes of me, no matter what my condition. I need and desperately want the presence of the one who made me, his embrace in the midst of a disease as ugly as Job's scabs, even his grief at this small instance of a world that is not what it should be. I believe I have those things, and with them, the ability to face a future that will likely be far worse than anything I've seen to date. Last but not least, I believe the time is coming, sooner than I wish, when, and this is a quote from the book of Job, when God is speaking to Job, "You will call, and I will answer you. You will long for the creature your hands have made. Surely then, you will count my steps, but not keep track of my sin." Sorry about that. So the common theme in really everything Bill did is scholarship, his relationship with his colleagues, his faith, was relationship. And his view of relationship was not that relationship was simple, it was that it was messy, it's complicated, it involves arguing and misunderstanding, but that at the end, our responsibility is to love each other. I'll stop with that.